This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. Good to be here, Nate.
Excellent. Well, we are 1 week away from going to, well, almost a week and a half away from going to Las Vegas and joining Chef AJ at her annual Ultimate Weight Loss Live conference. And this is every year on Labor Day weekend, Chef AJ puts on this amazing conference. And so I'm looking forward to going there next week and seeing you, Dr. Lyle, doing a talk, Dr. Goldhammer, Dr. Thomas Campbell, Dr. Roizen, High Carb Hannah, John Pierre. There's Chef AJ herself is doing a talk. So I'm really looking forward to going there and meeting some of the fans of the Beat Your Genes podcast. And Dr. Lyle, we're eagerly awaiting some of your talks and Q&As that are going to be there. So if any of our listeners are curious and they want to check it out, there's tickets are still available. You can go to chefajwebsite.com and then click on the three little bars here under comb and then click on the UWL Live 2019 link, and then you can go and register there. And if you want to get a discount code, you can just enter ESCAPE100 when you check out, and that'll give you $100 off your ticket. So, Dr. Lyle, are you pretty excited to go there, to go to Las Vegas next week?
Absolutely. And Dr. Jen Hawk is also going to be there, so you're going to be able to sit down, talk to Jen Hawk, and get an earful, Nathan.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to it. And I hear I hear from herself that she's a pretty highly open individual. And so, you know, finally we get to talk to an evolutionary psychologist who's got some novelty chips in there.
Oh, that's some fun. Yeah, I got it. I understand how this works. All right.
All right. Well, our show today, the title of the show is called Do Rewards Improve Motivation? And Can Parents Toughen Up Their Kids? And so there's obviously more questions after these questions, but I was interested in this topic because I was reading a thread on an internet forum and a question came up. And the question had to do with motivation, and it was, what's the psychology behind not wanting to perform a task after being told to do it, even if you were going to do it anyway? And so I remembered watching some kids TV show years ago, and I had heard this line, and I'd laughed pretty hard at it. And this was the line:
"Kill me, please."
Okay, but not because you told me to.
And then I also, as I was looking up this clip, obviously the villain in this clip says, "Kill me, please," and the main antagonist says, "Okay, fine, but not because you told me to." And then I was looking up this clip so I can put it on the show. And it's funny because I found a clip from Larry King Live when he was interviewing somebody from 30 Rock, and it's the same exact joke comes up.
Hang up on him, Larry.
I'm going to, but not because you told me.
So it's fascinating because I can sometimes remember when the same jokes are used across different social mediums. And so there must be something there. And I figured, who else to ask than Dr. Doug Lyle? And so in researching some of this, I found that there was some famous study done that kids actually spend less time drawing if you tell them that they'll get some award for doing a good picture. And if we can just take a few minutes and I'll kind of go over this study and then Dr. Lyle, you can explain it to us. So this was two psychologists, Mark Lepper and David Green from Stanford University and the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. And they were interested in testing what is known as the over-justification hypothesis. And so since parents, they use these rewards as motivators for children, they recruited 51 preschoolers between 3 and 4 years old. All the children selected for the study were interested in drawing. And it was really crucial that they actually already liked drawing because they wanted to see the effects, what effect rewards would have on children that were already fond of doing the activity. So they were randomly assigned to one of three possible conditions. One is an expected reward. So they were told they would get some certificate with a gold ribbon if they took part. The second condition was they had actually received the same reward as the first one, but they weren't told about it until after they finished drawing. And then the third condition was they had no reward at all. So they expected no reward and they didn't get one at all. And so they were invited into a separate room to draw for 6 minutes. And then afterwards, they were given their reward or not reward, depending on the condition. And then over the next few days, they were watched through one-way mirrors to see how much they would continue drawing on their own accord. And so what happened was the kids in the condition of no reward or surprise reward, they spent about 15 to 20% of their time drawing. And the kids who actually got the expected reward spent half the time drawing. And so it was pretty interesting to watch that that they were less motivated once they expected to be rewarded for the activity. And so, the authors of this study say that this had to do with intrinsic motivation. And they also cite that it's not only children who display this kind of reactions. And besides Larry King and the cartoon I just played, apparently studies have shown a similar effect in all sorts of different populations, like adults, for example. In one study, smokers who were rewarded for their efforts to quit did better at first, but after 3 months, they did worse than those given no rewards and no feedback. And so, and even those that were given rewards even lied more about the amount that they were smoking. And so this this effect concluded that tangible rewards tend to have a substantially negative effect on intrinsic motivation, even when tangible rewards are offered as indicators of good performance. And so they found that make people less creative, worse at problem solving, et cetera. So Dr. Lai, would you please hit us with the truth on this?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I have not thought about this. I haven't thought about it, so I'm just thinking of it for the first time. This is an old effect. I knew Mark Leppert. He was the head of the department at Stanford when I was teaching there. He's a famous experimental social psychologist, true blue, right out of the sort of Kurt Lewin. family tree. So Leppert is one of the greats. Now, this overjustification effect is it's kind of a curious effect. So it's like if you reward people for something, then for some reason the thinking is, I believe, mostly in social psychology has been, it's as if the person looks at themselves and says, why am I doing this? If I must have been partially doing this for the reward, and therefore, therefore I must not like it that much. And so now I'm going to do it less, as the reward is now not evident. And so that's the effect that I believe that's kind of what Leper and colleagues are thinking, that this is sort of a there's a whole bunch of guys, famous guys in that arena, 1970s, 1980s, looking at things like this. Daryl Bem, I believe, was also involved there. I've never really, one reason I haven't thought that much about the effects is I think that they're going to be short term. And I think that there may be funny little things that happen like this. This essentially the CB operations inside the person's mind can be a little confused about why it is that something was valuable to do. And it could actually be temporarily slightly confused about how to assign coefficients to the different motives potentially, and so particularly in a kid like this. And so as a result, maybe it holds on for a short period of time, the next time they, the next few times they draw. And then I would be extremely interested, which I'm sure they did not do, about following this up a month later. So my guess is that you know, if they looked at it a week later and a week after that, we would pretty soon find this effect going down. Now, however, that doesn't mean that it's not a curious effect. And so the notion that you might have an internal calculus trying to discern why it is that you're doing something, and that it could sniff out that if I'm being rewarded for it, maybe I don't really like it that much. That is, seems like a possible thing. Now, just as I was thinking this through, it occurred to me that there's another possible explanation, and I don't know, and I doubt if the leper genre of social psychologists ever thought about this. But I don't know, maybe they did. They're pretty sophisticated people, but they might not have ever considered the following concept. And that is that the person might be thinking, if I'm have a reward, then this thing may be valuable to the village. And if it's valuable to the village, maybe I ought to keep it scarce. Now, that could potentially explain an expected reward, but remember, an expected reward has been announced. And so the person is now getting clear that, why would anybody reward me? It's because it's valuable to them. And if it's valuable to them, then maybe I want to make this a scarce resource. On the other hand, you could also say, well, they got rewarded for it, but they didn't see it coming, and that did not undermine their intrinsic motivation. So they learned that it was valuable to the village. Not necessarily. So it's hard to know what inferences the person might make in those circumstances where the reward is a surprise, and when it's expected in advance and is meant to be an inducement, it's a little bit clearer that the village finds it valuable. So I could see that possibility operating on this system. But it's a nice, like I said, I have to tell you, Nathan, these are some of these things are curious, funny little findings that they find. For example, in cognitive dissonance theory, looks like it's associated with that to some degree. And so they're curious little neat demonstrations of experimental social psychology. I'm not sure exactly what to make of it. I do believe that in most cases, little things like this, little effects like this, usually fall away pretty quickly. In other words, they're tenuous little effects. I don't think they have a lot to do with significant human decision-making and motivation at all. But nevertheless, they're interesting. Mm-hmm. All right.
Do you think this has do you think this has any hallmarks of any potential ego trap going on? I.e., there might be an inference of the kid, of whoever's doing this, that if they're getting a reward, that means their actual performance is being judged, and therefore they should give up a little bit or not try as hard, lest they lose some status.
I'm not sure what to make of that. I don't think so. I don't know. I think it's more, I like the idea better that, I mean, I think the standard explanation, if we were to go back and read Leper, I think they're thinking that there's this inference that I must not like it that much because being rewarded must have been part of my motivation. So therefore I'm going to do it less. A curious line of reasoning, but it certainly fits the data, but I'm not sure it's right. An alternative explanation would be hey, this is appears to be valuable to the village, therefore make it a scarce resource. Don't give it away. And so that's a, I think that's a, I think what I've just come up with is a pretty potent explanation for this, that that may be a superior explanation or explain more of what's going on than the original. And I'm not sure I'm telling the real, they may have thought this through as well, but there's a good chance they didn't. So I think they were, they're pretty excited about this notion that human beings don't know why they're doing what they're doing. And that's one of the great hallmarks of experimental social psychology in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, sort of looking for these curious little effects where the person's walking around, you know, we know why they sort of did something, but they don't know why they did it. And of course, it's exciting and interesting, but I think that generally when that's the case, the effects are very tenuous, very tenuous little effects. And the notion that people don't know, you know, sort of don't know their motivations for things, certainly evolutionary psychology is going to point and say, listen, they don't know the distal reasons for those motivations, but they know the proximal reasons. So, you know, they know they're peeking around the corner to watch Susie dance. They can't tell you that the reason why they're watching her dance is because she looks like she's a very fertile specimen with low mutation loads, but they can tell you well enough.
What I wouldn't give to be at the junior high school dance with you in junior high and just have you elbow me in the side and say, hey, check out her little mutation loads over there. And you know, my experience would be so much better in high school.
I explained this to my dad. You know, I was about 50 and he was 80. And we went into some restaurant, some gal walked by and he goes, low mutation load. So apparently his detector was still working quite well at 80 years old. All right.
All right. Well, so enough of this topic, but as you're explaining this, I realized that the clips that I played of, I'll do it, but not because you told me to, actually don't have that much to do with this particular topic. So, so maybe we can recover a little bit and maybe you can explain to us what this, that phenomenon is, which is I'll do it, but not.
Yeah. That's also, actually that sort of thing that also, that notion and that, concept is, it was known in social psychology as reactance. And as I recall, there was a character named, I think, Rokich, and I can't remember exactly if I've got that right, but I think that I'm not going to remember this study right, that there was, I think there was a number of demonstrations basically telling people, for example, don't write on the back bathroom wall. And when you put that on there on the wall, then everybody wrote all over the wall. And so the I think there was different studies like that that they did demonstrating this reactance. And I don't think that we had a very good explanation for that in social psychology. I don't think they did actually, because I think that what you're seeing is human resistance to being to sending a signal that one is under somebody else's dominance. And so that's not in social psychological theory. And so this is the notion that I'm not going to do something at your direction because that would signal to the village that you are in fact in a dominant position over me. And I can't afford that. And I reject the fact that I'm going to do anything that is going to indicate to the village that that is in fact the case, because that would be expensive, particularly to my reproductive prospects. So that now explains the quote reactance phenomena of all those types of demonstrations that were done. And I think that pretty well settles it. So Larry King is basically telling this guy, yeah, I'm going to do that because it's reasonable, but I'm going to make sure that everybody knows that the reason I'm doing it is not because you're in a dominant position over me, because you are not.
Mm.
And so that's why it is that someone might say something like that.
Now, would that be a similar reason? Like, I actually felt this emotion a lot growing up, where my parents would tell me to do something.
Yeah.
Or I was already going to do something to gain some Stone Age money, like take out the trash when I wasn't asked to, or, clean up the kitchen or something like that, where it wasn't expected of me, but I wanted to get some credit for it. And then my mom goes, oh, by the way, can you please clean up the kitchen? I'm like, dang it. Like I was going to do that already. And now it looks like you told me to do it. Not that I was going to do it on my own.
Yeah, I think that probably still holds. The I think the thread is still in there. That if you've got a little disagreeable streak, and you're particularly,
right.
I would say also very clearly that this is going to happen between mothers and sons. Particularly it's going to happen a lot as the sons get large enough that they could start looking mom in the eye, and you're going to start getting some dominance hierarchy challenges that way. So eventually you'll probably get them between father and son. So my dad and I finally had, a dominance hierarchy challenge or two. Yeah, I had to wait till I was like 35. those things can finally happen where if you feel like it's expensive to demonstrate submission and you run a CB and you say, no, I'm not going to signal it. I'm going to defy that signal. I'm going to make it clear that I'm not picturing myself in that slot. So I think that's largely what you're seeing there.
Fascinating. Yeah. All right. Well, we've got a few questions today, so we'll just get right down to them. So, dear Dr. Weil, with regards to the ego and pleasure traps, if one wants to instill a sense of motivation, do we set goals and fundamentals that solicit a stress response as opposed to soliciting an anxious or depressive response? How do you decide on a goal or the fundamentals that can begin the process of getting you out of this trap, ego or pleasure trap? Is it a matter of deciding what is 10% better than you are currently doing or something else?
Good question. And I would say the way to look at this is look at it the way that you would, if you're in an ego trap, a good way to think about an ego trap would be that your peers think that you can jump over the high jump that's 3.5 feet because you're a pretty good athlete and they can jump over it and they've done it. And you walk up to that thing and it's intimidating. And so that's a good time to say that you got a pull muscle in your calf and you'll try it tomorrow. In other words, you don't want to do it. So what we want to do in principle is to lower the bar. That's how we're going to get out of the ego trap. So we're going to lower the bar down to a level that is very, very low, but looks like it's very doable. So there's at some level where the person looks at that bar, might be 2 feet, and they think, I know I can get over that. Good. So now that's what we do. That's where we set the fundamental down pretty close to where it is that they've got very high confidence that they can do it. And what we're going to do is we're going to say, okay, we're going to begin there and we may move pretty quickly, but we're going to find out. We don't know. We're not really sure what this is going to look like. So we set the bar there. And then if it's easy, then we move it up. And then if it's still easy, we move it up a little bit more. So, and for some of these things, depending upon what the goal is, again, so it's hard to give a general answer to a question because there's going to be specific issues that are involved. So let's suppose it's, eating healthy food. Well, eating healthy food isn't conceptually difficult. It's more an issue of sort of determination and consistency than it is ability. So that's a different issue. And so so then we want to set the bar at a level that the person's internal audience feels like that they have actually accomplished something at the end of some cycle where we're going to be putting down some kind of data. Sometimes records can be a really useful thing. So not for everybody, but sometimes records of any kind of thing, like for weight loss, for example, I use a thing called starch targets where I have a little sheet that I have people check off on a daily basis what it is that they did today. And in doing so, they can get a sense that they did a pretty good job, because that's, I'm setting the bar at a level that is doable for everybody. But the goal is to do this at about 80% level, which is very reasonable, but not trivial. And so the so that's actually how we're trying to go about these things, is set the bar at a reasonable level, but not trivial. That would be true of the high jump as well. So we might immediately set the high jump quite low as the person easily goes over it. Then we set it up at a reasonable level, but not trivial, where they're going to feel a little bit of stress. So it's going to feel like a modest challenge, but they can do it. And then if I was trying to teach the kid the high jump, I would have them at that level for a while. So let's suppose it was, we started and they were intimidated by 3.5 feet. And so we started it back at 2 feet, and that was too easy. And then we went to 2 feet and 4 inches, and that was still too easy. And then we went to 2 feet and 8 inches, and they got over it, but it was a little tense, and they might've dinged the bar with their foot a little bit. Maybe they even kicked it off at the end, but they came out of there thinking, no, I can definitely do that. I just got to get my foot over the bar. So now when we do it again at 2, 8, and they're all again successful, we might sit right there for a while. So, for the rest of practice, we might be at 2, 8, and we might be focusing on the little fundamentals that are associated with that, trying to get our run up, in a certain number of paces, et cetera. And we're just going to work those fundamentals, and we're not going to raise the bar any. That's how we might do it. And so then once it feels like downright boring and not challenging, now we're going to raise the bar maybe to 2 feet 10, and just a little up. And the person feels a little bit of stress, but they feel high percentage perceived probability of success. And now we raise it up and they are probably successful, but they feel the tension and the uncertainty. And then we do the same thing and we just work those fundamentals again. Okay. And so this is how it is that this is how motivation works, is it works behind essentially, an interwoven matrix of several considerations. And that is, what do other people think I can do? What do I think I can do? And what is my internal audience observing with respect to the dynamic between those two things? And so by starting low, we make sure that the individual has a very high perceived probability of success, very high. And now we slightly cinch that to where it feels a little bit more stressful and a little bit, a little bit more challenging. And we cinch it up and cinch it up until we're at a place where they feel like they have to work very hard and be focused in order to be consistently successful. So that's how we do it. And that's how we do it really in principle, whether we're teaching somebody to write essays or we're teaching somebody to throw a football or we're trying to teach them math problems. It's all works according to the same basic formula that's the way out of the ego trap. And it's also the way to a continued cycle of motivation and increased confidence with increased accomplishment.
Fascinating. So as long as we don't pay them to practice, it'll be fine, according to the
author. Yeah, very good. Yeah.
Just kidding. All right. Okay, our next question. Dr. Lyle, can parents toughen up their children, including infants, so that they don't cry as much by pampering them less? In other words, is there evidence sensitive or whiny.
I lost you for just a second. Yeah, go ahead and read it again from the top for me.
Okay. Dear Dr. Lau, can parents toughen up their children, including infants, so that they don't cry as much by pampering them less? In other words, is there evidence that you can make infants cry less or make young children less sensitive or whiny by letting them have to deal with a little discomfort rather than helping them out all the time?
Good question. And I have to say that I don't have enough experience with kids to tell you the answer. Now, there's two different levels of answer. So with respect to one of the questions, the long-term question, I can give you the answer. The short-term question is sort of the manipulation of childhood whining and crying. I'm sure that there's some short-term techniques that are potentially useful. I know about some of them because I invented one. All right. So the big question is sort of, can you toughen up your kids and make them less inherently sensitive and sort of a tougher animal, et cetera? No, you cannot. That is not possible. So the reason why I say that definitively is the extensive research that has been done on personality and genetics. So we now know that there's going to be no known process by which any environmental input is going to have a predictable, systematic influence on personality development. So good question, reasonable question. And you can see why people would think that the answer would be, sure, you can toughen up your kids. You know, gosh, if you've got a bunch of softies from Beverly Hills, go put them in the ghetto and abandon them for a year. Let's toughen them up. Okay. So the answer is no, they'll be the same soft kid basically in a year. Personality is quite immutable. Now the question is whether or not what's going to go on with the crying and the whining. Now that is going to change depending upon the circumstances. And so if you change your behavior, it could very well change the behavior of the child. So I didn't do any crying and whining around my father because my father just wasn't going to put up with it, wasn't interested. And it became clear that whatever it was, you know, if I'm crying because I'm physically hurt, he wouldn't say, shut up. He wouldn't. He'd be perfectly reasonable. But what my dad was reasonable and stable, and he wasn't particularly sympathetic if what was frustrating me was sort of the normal vicissitudes of childhood life. So therefore, it didn't exactly encourage a bunch of whining and crying. My mother, similarly, softer than my dad, but not particularly soft about that issue. So nicer. So I'm probably cried more to my mother, but I don't remember doing a lot of crying, quite frankly, but you can't remember anything before you're 3 years old anyway. So I have no idea what was going on when I was 1.5. I probably did plenty of crying. Now, so another thing, so therefore what I'm essentially saying is that parental behavior or caregiver behavior could certainly reinforce or punish these kinds of displays. And so those would change according to this is operant conditioning. So this is essentially if you were a modern cognitive theorist, you'd say, well, doesn't that necessarily have to be operant conditioning? It could actually be top-down analysis of the cost-benefit analysis of a behavior. So you could figure out what the contingencies were. It wouldn't have to be an operant or unconscious process. So the deal is that with kids that I will, with kids that are probably a little bit older than this, I will do some sharp angling. So if they're whining, I'll say, "Hey, it's too bad. You'll be fine. You'll live without it." Whatever it is, whining about the situation that something got taken from them unfairly or whatever the deal was. If it seems perfectly reasonable to me, I don't mind at all shrugging my shoulders and saying, hey, doesn't sound like anything that you can't handle. And this is essentially deflecting them out of a strategy where crying and whining are manipulative instincts that are activated under conditions where the cost benefit looks like it's going to be worth it. So if you can think that you can get resources by whining and crying, then you're likely to do so. And if it looks like that's not going to work, then you're probably going to shut down that strategy. Now, with infants, I would be very resistant about trying to be sharp angling an infant, for God's sakes. An infant, if they're crying, they're uncomfortable. And so we're trying to discern what the nature of that discomfort is, and we want to put them under comfortable circumstances. So I'm not, you know, there's probably people that deal with infants all day long and probably have their little magic about what they think is a good thing to do, et cetera. But generally, my attitude would be to indulge that infant in a way to try to knock down that crying, you know, if you can figure out what to do. But when kids gets a little older, the kid is now a more clever manipulative device. And if the crying and whining that they're doing looks, you know, essentially like you can understand what they're saying and understand what's upsetting them, and this is clearly part of a strategic manipulative package to try to get you to intervene, maybe it's worth intervening. Maybe it's not. But if it doesn't look like it, if it looks like it's something that they can settle themselves, then my attitude would be, hey, you know, you're just going to have to choke it down. That's all right. You'll live through it. There'll still be dinner time at dinner time. And by doing this, they will figure out, hey, it's not worth it. It's not going to fly. Whereas if they have a legitimate beef, then we, you know, pay attention to it and are essentially if we're impressed with the logic and the injustice of the situation, then that's something else again. So that's how I look at this. It's essentially just like if you're running a car wash or you're running a prison, you have to have rules and expectations, and the people will behave according to what they think the payoff matrix looks like. So if they think that they can show up late and not punch in and still get paid because they said that they were there, that's what they're likely to do. If they better show up before the thing, before the shift goes on and make sure they're punched in, they'll make sure that that happens too. And so, and the same thing with kids, they're not going to be generally doing an awful lot of whining and crying unless it's working. So sometimes it's working a little too well. And however, we will not, incidentally, kids being uncomfortable under situations or frustrated or mad or feeling like they've been treated unjustly, this isn't hurting them. It's not doing any damage. It's also the case that if we do things a little tougher, it's also not going to toughen them up in the long run. It will not change their personality 1%. So if you've got a little whiner, crier on your hand and it continues on, even though you may knock it down in your own house by being a little tougher to manipulate, believe me, this is going to be going on for the rest of their lives. This is endemic to the personality structure. And so therefore, nothing that you're going to do is going to influence that personality trajectory as they go throughout the course of their lives.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I was in the patio and playing on a swing that my dad had built for me and my sisters, and I fell down, hurt my knee on the concrete. Mm-hmm. I remember like crying a little bit, and I was like looking up at my mom to see if she would react and either come and, you know, mm-hmm. check out what was happening, and she, because we end up she would look at me and then kind of go back to doing her thing, and then later when I grew up, we were talking about this exact thing of, you know, toughen up your kids and seeing if, you know, she had believed, and we talked about this, you know, she thought that psychologically that kids need to be taught to not whine to their parents that much. And so she brought that up, and I remember that moment. It was funny because she said, "Yeah, no, I saw you. You weren't in dire straits. You weren't bleeding. Mm-hmm. You weren't fractured. I just was paying attention to your sister's homework." And so, 20 years later, my knee hurts every once in a while, and I still blame her.
Well said, Nathan. You go ahead and hold that grudge for a while longer.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. No question. I love you, Mom.
Oh my.
All right.
Yeah. All right. Let's go on.
So, Dr. Lai, you brought up a sharp angle. Can you explain to us what that means?
Yeah. Yeah. Sharp angle is a description of a clinical strategy that I developed, 25 years ago. And so it's when I would hear, whenever I hear complaining out of adults, and sort of unconsciously I'm processing that their complaint is not reasonable. And so, there are complaints that are reasonable and there's complaints that aren't reasonable. And when they're not reasonable, what I do is probably somewhat different than a typical clinical psychologist, because I'm not necessarily that warm and fuzzy. If you want warm and fuzzy with evolutionary psychology, you need to talk to Dr. Jen Hawk. But careful when you bring complaints to me, you might hit a sharp angle. So here's a sharp angle. So I had a young lady come to me, and she had her fiance, and they both came from well-to-do families. And her family they were young, and they had decided by George that they were going to get married at this young age. And her parents had a very beautiful, lovely home that with a gorgeous yard that could have been, I guess that was going to be the site of the wedding. And she was bent out of shape about the limited financial resources that her dad was willing to pony up for this whole thing, knowing full well that he was very well to do. And so I'm looking at this highly attractive young lady, super well educated. I won't delineate what that is. And her super attractive, super well educated, soon to be young spouse. And I'm thinking, you've got to be kidding me. Like, you're whining to me about how, you can't have $250 floral arrangements, and that they're going to, they're limiting what they're going to pay, so you can only have 125 or 150 people. Like, hey, I don't remember what the complaints were, but they were ridiculous. Yeah, this was a rich kid's complaint. And so we're about, 7 to 9 minutes into our therapy session, and I just said, your parents don't owe you anything. Like, where do you get this idea?
That's not a typical psychologist.
Okay.
For sure.
Yeah. So that's a sharp angle. In other words, it's I'm not pussyfooting around here. It's like you come with a bogus, whiny complaint, and you're going to get called on it right in your face. And it was obviously not the response that she got from her other therapist. So, and that young lady wrote me a letter a year later. I still have it. And she said, dear Dr. Lyle, I just want to tell you from our session, it completely transformed the relationship between myself and my parents. She said, it was uncomfortable to hear what you had to say, but, I never had seen it from that perspective. And now I do. I just see things completely differently. I.e., they don't owe me anything. And so, that's sharp angle. So that kid just needed a little tap on the head, and suddenly her brain was able to clear out. I actually didn't expect that. I expected that I actually had a whiny, entitled, disagreeable, manipulative princess. That's what I thought I had. And I wasn't going to sit there and let the princess whine, because that's me. If you're a princess and you want to whine, talk to Jen Hawk. She'll be very, very sweet and very gentle, and it'll you might get the same message, but it'll come with such smooth edges. Talk
yeah,
to me.
Talk to Jen Hawk,
you're gonna get a ball peen hammer.
All right, I'm scheduling Dr. Jen Hawk then, Dr. Lyle. I'm a princess and I feel
what's
like
that?
Whining. Is it?
Yeah, when you feel like whining, you know where to go now.
Yeah. So how do we get in touch with Dr. Jen Hawk then?
She, actually, I think she's now on my website. So I think
yeah.
that's true. I haven't checked, but I was given a rumor that they've almost got their act together. So she might be there now. But if
yeah,
not,
yeah.
she's going to be on that website very, very shortly.
Excellent. All right, Dr.
All
Lyle.
Right. Let's go on.
All right.
So what else we have?
Dear Dr. Lyle, when you talk about narcissists, you usually discuss those who come across as highly disagreeable, but it seems that some of these narcissists can actually be very charming. Can you explain the charming narcissist and how to spot one?
A charming narcissist could be very extroverted and have a great sense of humor, be physically attractive with a big smile, big expressive smile, and be low enough conscientiousness to be deceptive and manipulative as hell. So the thing to look for is to look for the streak of disagreeable and look for when it's substantial. And another place to look is for the lower conscientiousness. In other words, the willingness to be very deceptive. The narcissist is what that really is that's disagreeable. And that's what, we start to call it narcissism when we start reaching, the 90th percentile of disagreeable. And so what's happening there is that somebody that's up at that level for disagreeable really feels like the world's pretty damn unfair. They really feel like their name ought to be in lights. They ought to be in charge. They ought to be able to get what they want. And this doesn't mean that they aren't very hardworking and productive and talented and successful. They might be of all those things, or they might be none of them. But if they are, they may have a great deal of wealth and social capital and everything else under the sun. However, beneath the charming veneer, you're going to see evidence of the disagreeable streak. And it will usually come in flashes of anger that will surprise you in their aggressiveness. And that's what that is. So the veneer that you're seeing can be extroversion, inherent sense of humor, a lot of times good looks, and particularly the lower in conscientiousness. They don't have to be low. They're just not high. And if they're average in conscientiousness and they're very disagreeable, those two dimensions together lay the groundwork for the justification of being deceptive. Remember, if you feel like the world is really not giving you your due, then you are far more willing to be deceiving other people into giving you your due. Okay, it just seems like it's reasonable. Here's a great example of a narcissist with no charm, in my judgment, but operating along the same dimension of two things, which is Lance Armstrong. So Lance Armstrong, very extremely disagreeable. So we're talking 100th percentile. And so is he conscientious? Well, super hardworking guy, a lot of conscientiousness, but you can see the willingness to be deceptive as hell. And it feels justified to a flaming narcissistic person like Armstrong that it was reasonable that he was cheating and deceiving everybody like crazy. Why? Because everybody else is doing it. Yeah. Well, not everybody. Talk to Greg Lamond. That's what the person is saying here. Lance Armstrong with a personality could look like, a very charming individual. And it could look like that they were, quote, not narcissistic, but you're going to see some ruthless behavior along this dimension. And usually you're going to see flashes of anger that are pretty intense and they're more intense than you would normally see out of a normal person. When a normal person has something happen to them that seems unfair, it's a they don't have the blazing rage that you will often see, you know, out of a highly disagreeable person that I would describe as narcissistic. And so that, no matter how charming and pleasant, when the switch flips and you see that rage in there, you know that the rest of it is just a fancy veneer.
Fascinating. Yeah, we've all had some experiences with these flaming narcissists, and you're absolutely right. At least from what I understand, my experience is like that veneer comes off. And I've had a few experiences, and it's shocking. Like, oh, okay, that was buried under there.
right. There it was. Suddenly, you're looking at a reptile,
mm-hmm.
and essentially a very low empathy animal that is really feeling justified at aggression because they feel like things are just outrageously unfair in a way that normal people rarely feel about anything other than their sports team. If their sports team has been, if they've had a call against their guys, then, you know, man, that's cause for it. But usually not about themselves, interestingly enough.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What else we got going? Anything else?
Yeah, we've got one more quick one. Yeah, we do a quick one. Dear Dr. Lau, what happens when someone is acting playful, childish, or even sometimes a little annoying or bratty, like teasing and saying outrageous things? Are they trying to evoke some sort of parental instincts? Are they being self-deprecating or something else?
An interesting description, and I'm trying to read between the lines here, because some of those things, they don't necessarily all hang together, but they might hang together. The closest thing that I'm hearing in that is flirtatiousness. So people will do teasing, they will act playful, they'll act childish, they'll be annoying and bratty. They'll say outrageous things. So I would have to question the person who wrote this as to who they had in mind and what the circumstances were. But what you're describing there sounds like, you know, 17-year-old girl or boy trying to signal to somebody that they're interested. So those are all sort of flirtatious strategies, and sometimes older people too.
Yeah. Hey, what about us? What if we act like this?
Yeah, this is sort of flirtation 101. And these are ways that people go about trying to signal that they're interested in a partner, is by doing these kinds of things. This sort of Tom Sawyer comes to mind, you know, the kind of goofy things that people will do, but they're signaling like crazy. So I think that's more what this person's observing.
Mm-hmm. Now, when they're signaling, what are they signaling? Obviously they're signaling flirtatious behavior and sexual interest.
Right.
Are they signaling that they're willing to be submissive through their childish behavior, or that the other person has fewer gene mutation loads or
let's think about that. Yeah. Let's talk about this. So sometimes these can be testing mechanisms to see if the person's interested in us. So we might say provocative things. And then, actually this is a really good question, because I think that these are instinctual strategies. So I don't remember reading these in David Buss's ACT, what he calls ACT psychology, or ACT. Buss was very interesting in the way he did research. He did exhaustive work looking at the different kinds of things that people do, and summarizing and categorizing acts that people use as strategies for flirtation. These aren't coming to mind, but they're probably in there because, as I recall, he would come up with like 118 different acts that people have been known to use to try to signal interest. And so I'm sure they're in there. So but we'd have to think through, and I don't know that any more thought has gone into this. I'm trying to think, being playful. That's playful is possibly, I mean, there's that goes a wide variety of behaviors, but that just looks flirtatious like crazy to me. And so these are roundabout ways of testing about whether or not the other person is interested. So there's less status at risk than just going right up to somebody and talking to them. This is the wimp's way of doing things. This is the way I would have done things, and Alan Goldhammer never would have.
Disarm or I guess get people to lower their guard if you're more childish in the same way that a presenter might use cartoons versus PowerPoint slides with, you know, wrote text on them, right?
Yeah, I remember back in my undergrad days, I was flirting with the young lady that I married, and I would I can remember at one point I put little wrapped pieces of candy down at intervals in the hallway that led to my office. We worked in the same lab with a cognitive psychologist, George Mandler. And so, yeah, that was a playful thing to do. That's what this is. It's kind of childlike and goofy way to signal.
Nowadays we would do it with like baked potatoes, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. wouldn't work. So why bother? I think I'd still use the candy. All right. I think that's good, Nathan.
All right. Very good, Dr. Lyle. We'll look forward to talking with you next week and seeing you in Las Vegas and seeing all of our any fans that see us in Las Vegas as well. So Dr. Lyle, we'll chat with you next week.
Fantastic. See you then.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.